Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezekiel chapter 45. In our last chapter, we finished describing Ezekiel's New Covenant Temple, a visionary symbol of the New Covenant Church. And today we're going to look at, in chapter 45, the land of Israel around the temple. And we'll look at some miscellaneous offerings and holy days near the end of the chapter. Now, this vision, as per all the visions of the New Covenant Temple in Ezekiel 40 through 48, was given in around 573, maybe 572. That's about 12 or 13 years after the destruction of Jerusalem in 586, and about 36 or 37 years before the return of Israel from Babylon to Israel under Zerubbabel. So we begin now in Ezekiel 45, 1 through 6. When you allot the land as inheritance, this is Yahweh still speaking to Ezekiel. When you allot the land as an inheritance, you are to present to the Lord a portion of the land as a sacred district, 25,000 cubits long and 20,000 cubits wide. The entire area will be holy. Of this, a section 500 cubits square is to be for the sanctuary, with 50 cubits around it for open land. In the sacred district, measure off a section 25,000 cubits long and 10,000 cubits wide, and it will be the sanctuary, the most holy place. It will be the sacred portion of the land for the priests who minister in the sanctuary and who draw near to minister before the Lord. It will be a place for their houses as well as a holy place for the sanctuary. An area 25,000 cubits long and 10,000 cubits wide will belong to the Levites, who serve in the temple as their possession for towns to live in. You are to give the city as its property an area 5,000 cubits wide and 25,000 cubits long, adjoining the sacred portion. It will belong to the whole house of Israel. Now, of course, as you can tell, but as we read through that, this is not going to be easy. So I'm going to try to summarize it with maps to start with. And as I describe the tribal layout as given by Ezekiel on the maps, I'm going to contrast where the tribes were in Ezekiel's vision and where they were in actuality on the ground during the time of the kingdoms of Israel. And you will see that Ezekiel's allotment has no resemblance at all to any historical allotment of land, either after Joshua allotted the land upon his entry into the promised land, or under Zerubbabel when he returned from Babylonia with the Babylonian exiles. Those allotments of the land had nothing to do with Ezekiel's land allotments. A general summary of these differences is given by the English Standard Version.org researchers page. Quote, Ezekiel's final vision describes the boundaries of a restored Israel, including the allotment to each tribe in the temple, rather than following the boundaries traditionally occupied by the Israelites, which included Gilead east of the Jordan River and excluded land north of Tyre. Ezekiel's new boundaries generally follow those described by Moses in Numbers 34. Ezekiel's vision also departs from the traditional allotment of the land among the 12 tribes and reassigns the land in horizontal bands from north to south. Well, the outward boundaries might conform to Moses as described in Numbers 34, but the individual tribal boundaries do not, as we'll see. They're not even close. Now, let me give you some examples of the differences of the allotments. In Ezekiel's vision, the prince's portion, the priest's portions, and the temple portion extend from sea to sea, from the Mediterranean to the Dead Sea, or the Sea of Galilee, and the location of the tribal lands are all different. There are no trans-Jordan tribes to the east of the Jordan in the north. Gad and Manasseh are missing. We've got Judah to the north of Benjamin, just for example. And in fact, I'm going to go through each tribe and show you the differences. Let's look at Ezekiel's vision. First of all, he has Dan in the far north. That's no difference there. Dan is in the far north as the tribes were divided in the times of the kings. And then south of Dan, between Tyre and Mount Carmel on the Mediterranean coast, we have Asher. Asher runs from west to east south of Dan, so that's roughly the same, except that Ezekiel's vision has Asher going much further to the east in a rectangular shape. Naphtali is south of Asher in Ezekiel's vision. In the actual historical layout, Naphtali was to the east of Asher, not to the south. Manasseh in Ezekiel's vision is to south of Naphtali. That's pretty much the same as in Ezekiel's vision, no difference there. Ephraim is to the south of Manasseh in Ezekiel's vision, that's the same. But there's a big difference. Manasseh is way to the north, all the way up around Mount Hermon. But in the actual historical tribal layout, Manasseh was much further to the south than that, south of the Sea of Galilee. Ditto for Ephraim. So those tribal placements are different. Reuben had its allotment under Joshua and in the kings to the east of the Dead Sea. But in Ezekiel's vision, Reuben is to the west of the Dead Sea, right southeast of the Sea of Galilee. It's not even close, right to the southwest. But Reuben, in Ezekiel's vision, has its allotment to the southwest of the Sea of Galilee and to the southeast of Mount Carmel. That's not even close. Judah comes next south of Reuben in Ezekiel's vision. It's a little bit to the north of where it was actually in historical times. Benjamin is south of Judah in Ezekiel's vision. That's exactly backwards as it was in historical times. Simeon is to the south of Judah in historical times, but to the south of Benjamin in Ezekiel's vision. But that's roughly in the same place, not too much difference. But now in Ezekiel's vision, Issachar, Zebulun are way down in the Negev, south of the Dead Sea even, almost to the brook of Egypt, almost to the border of Egypt, almost down to Kadesh Barnea. That's in Ezekiel's vision, but in actual historical times, Zebulun and Issachar were just to the southwest of the Sea of Galilee, way up in the north. Total difference there. And last of all, Gad, in Ezekiel's vision, is in the far south, way down, even south of the Negev, in Arabia Petraea, headed toward Egypt. That's in Ezekiel's vision, but Gad, in actuality, after Joshua had apportioned the land, Gad was to the east of the Jordan River, from just north of the Dead Sea, about three-quarters of the way up the Jordan River, heading toward the Sea of Galilee, which is nowhere near Egypt. So you can see there is absolutely, or almost absolutely, no correlation between the historical allotment of tribes and Ezekiel's vision. Now, what does this mean? Well, it tends to show the meaning of this vision is symbolic. It was not meant to be literal. Now, of course, there will be some who will say that this weird tribal allotment by Ezekiel will take place in a future pre-mill millennium, but I don't believe in that, so I'm just going to say that all this is symbolic. Now, there are other commentators who agree with that. Some of them say that this is symbolic of the church. Some say it's the heavenly allotments of the saints, not during the church era, but in the final state. I'm not going to worry about that too much. We will try to squeeze some symbolism out of it as we finish describing it. Now, if you say the allotments are literal, you got a lot of problems, as I'll show you later. First of all, if you say this is referring to a literal allotment of land on the Jews' return from Babylon, the problem is the land wasn't divided afresh at that time. Here's what Adam Clark says. When on your repossessing your land, every family settles according to the allotment which they formerly had, for it is certain that the land was not divided afresh by lot after the Babylonish captivity. The allotment mentioned and described here was merely for the service of the temple, the use of the priest and the prince or governor of the people. A division of the whole land is not intended. Well, I have a question to ask of that. Why is such a fantastical allotment of the land of use to the priest and the prince? I don't think there is any use that I can see, so I still say that this is symbolic. Now, the next question we have, if all these allotments of land are figurative, what was the purpose of it? Now, there are people who have speculated a little bit on that. I'm going to give you my speculations. I think that Ezekiel was speaking figuratively, so we wouldn't suppose that he was speaking of the return from Babylon, as if this were to be some kind of law that the Jews were to follow when they came back. It was obvious they couldn't follow that land allotment. It was physically impossible. So if Ezekiel guards against a literal interpretation of his vision, that leaves us open to understand that the vision refers to the New Covenant Church. Now let's begin with verse 1 and some of these measurements. We are looking at a sacred portion of the land, a sacred district, as the NIV translates. And this district is 20,000 cubits wide and 25,000 cubits long. Now, I'm going to assume that this rectangular district, 25,000 cubits by 20,000 cubits, is the same district that's mentioned in verse 3, where we have another district 25,000 cubits long and 10,000 cubits wide. Now, I said those two districts were the same, but the problem is in verse 1 in the NIV translation, the district is 20,000 cubits wide, whereas in verse 3 it's 10,000 cubits wide. That leads us to the problem, that leads us to a textual problem. The Masoretic text has 10,000 cubits. The Septuagint Greek translation of the Hebrew text has 20,000 cubits. So there's a textual problem there. The modern English translation split. Some say 10,000, for example, the King James, the New King James, Young's Literal Translation, J.P. Green's Literal Translation say 10,000. But many others say 20,000. For example, the ESV has 20,000, as well as the NIV, which I'm reading now. So, we have confusion there, textual problem. We also have a problem in that the original text does not even mention the measurements. In addition to the textual problem, we also have the problem that the original text does not have units of measurements. It just says 25,000 long. And so the translators split between should we put in 25,000 cubits or 25,000 reeds. A reed is 6 cubits. The old translations, like the King James, the American Standard Version, have reeds. The modern translations tend to put cubits. Now, I don't want to get too much into the weeds here, but I started playing with the numbers a little bit. Let's assume the width of this sacred district is 10,000 cubits, and not reeds, but cubits. Well, a cubit, a standard cubit, is 15,000 feet. We have another problem. Do we use the standard cubit or the royal cubit? Standard cubit is 18 inches. Royal cubit is 20.6 inches. But let's just say the standard cubit, so 15,000 feet, is 2.84 miles. Now, you might say that might be a little bit small for the sacred district, which included not only the temple, but of course, houses for the priest. And so I'm going to give you an argument from Ellicott that says that cubits is too small a measurement and that reeds should be used, 6 cubits instead of 1 cubit. Ellicott says this, in the original there is no mention of the measure to be used, but the English has rightly supplied reeds. This is plain both from the size of the precincts of the temple, which are made 500 reeds square in verses 16 through 20, Ezekiel 42, and from the special mention of cubits in Ezekiel 45, verse 2, implying that the measure in other cases was different. Now, if you look at Ezekiel 45, verse 2, you will see in the original text, cubit mentioned, and if you look at Ezekiel 42, verses 16 through 20, you will see reeds mentioned. Ellicott goes on to say that 25,000 reeds is something over 47 statute miles, whatever a statute mile is. So we're looking at the difference between 3 miles and about 50 miles. I really don't think that that's really a problem, whichever way you take it. Ellicott makes a strong argument that the measurement should be reeds here, but most of the modern translations don't do that. And I've got 2 modern translations that put the measurements into English units, which will help English speakers picture the size of this holy sacred district just a little bit better. Verses 1 through 3 in God's Word translation says this, divide the land by drawing lots for the property you will inherit. Set aside an area 43,750 feet long and 35,000 feet wide for the Lord. The entire area will be holy. An area of 875 feet square will be for the holy place with an open area 87.5 feet wide. Measure off an area of 43,750 feet long and 17,500 feet wide. The holy place, that is the most holy place, the Holy of Holies in other words, will be in this area. Now the problem with that, of course, it's hard for us to picture that many feet. Another problem is that the horizontal distance of 43,750 feet is difficult to see where that came from. I assume that God's Word translation used the royal cubit, and Wikipedia tells me that the royal cubit could either be 20.6 inches or 20.64 inches, but either way, I can come close to 43,750, but not exactly. So let's look at the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. When you divide the land by lot as an inheritance, you must set aside a donation to the Lord, a holy portion of the land, 8 1/3 miles long and 6 2/3 miles wide. So now we get a feel. Assuming a royal cubit, you transfer that to miles, you get 8 1/3 by 6 2/3 miles. That's reasonable. Again, it's too big to be a place for a temple, but this piece of land also included land for the priest and houses for the priest. This entire tract of land will be holy. In this area, there will be a square section for the sanctuary, 875 by 875 feet. That's a reasonable size for a temple complex, with 87.5 feet of open space all around it, all around the temple. From this holy portion, you will measure off an area 8 1/3 miles long and 3 1/3 miles wide, in which the sanctuary, the most holy place, will stand. Well, the temple itself is reasonable, but the temple having a courtyard of 8 miles long and 3 miles wide, that is a huge courtyard. And that's just using cubits. If you use reeds, it's even bigger. Now, that seems quite large, but if you assume that the measurements in verse 3 are the same in verse 1, and we're talking about a long section, 8 1/3 miles long and 3 1/3 miles wide, that includes the land of the priests, and the sanctuary is in the middle of that, and you don't infer from that that the land 8 1/3 miles long and 3 1/3 miles wide is merely the land around the sanctuary, but it includes the houses of the Levites, then the sanctuary does not seem like it has an excessively large courtyard. So what are my tentative conclusions from all this confusion? I think a cubit rather than a reed will work, like most of the modern translations. And even with cubit measurements, the sections might seem very large and out of proportion. They seem to be a little bit large, but you can answer that by saying the large size is necessary to accommodate the priests and their houses, not to mention the city and its food, which is also mentioned. And I assume that verses 1 and verses 3, when they mention this rectangular piece of land, is talking about the same rectangle. Now, I'm going to look at a map. This is provided by the English Standard Version on their organizational resources page. And I'm going to look at this holy portion. It's located right basically where Jerusalem was in historical times, maybe a little bit south of it. And in this holy portion, going from west to east, we see three divisions. Going from the west to the east in the first division is the prince's land. That forms a rectangle. And then on the far eastern end of the holy portion, going from the eastern boundary inland, is another portion of land called the prince's land. So the prince's land surrounds, like a sandwich, around the middle section of this holy portion. The middle section is divided into three parts. The northernmost part belongs to the Levites. The middle part belongs to the priest, with a temple right in the middle of the priest section. And the southernmost part has the city of Jerusalem, and food storage areas to the east and west of the city. Now, if we take the Masoretic text version, which says that the Levites' portion is 10,000 cubits wide, we have a perfect square for the sacred district. The Levites' portion was 10,000 cubits wide. The priest's portion was 10,000 cubits wide. And the city's portion was 5,000 cubits wide, for a total of 25,000 cubits. So if the total distance north to south was 25,000 cubits and the length east to west was 25,000 cubits, we have a perfect square. And of course, the temple is in a perfect square that symbolizes perfection. And that just sounds like the way it should go. I don't know why the Septuagint had the priest width as 20,000 cubits. But we're going to go with 10,000 cubits with the Masoretic Hebrew text to create a perfect square. One little detail in verse 6, the 5,000 cubit width portion that belongs to the city is of different measurements than is given in the city in Ezekiel 48. Verse 30, which reads, "These are the exits of the city on the north side, 4,500 cubits. Now, I'll try to square up the measurements or deal with that problem when we get to Ezekiel 48. We've got enough problems here to deal with, so I'm going to pass that on by. Now, let's step away from some of this confusion and detail. I'm going to give you 10 observations from Daniel I. Block concerning Ezekiel's allotment. Observation number 1. Ezekiel's map involves the descendants of all the original sons of Jacob, with the Joseph tribe divided into Ephraim and Manasseh, as had been the case when Joshua originally allotted tribal territories. All right, so there's no difference as to who the 12 tribes were. Observation number 2, the outer boundaries of the land of Israel, from Hethlon and Lebo Hamath in the north to the river of Egypt, the Wadi El Arish, in the south, corresponds with ancient Egyptian definitions of the land of Canaan. Observation number 3. Ezekiel's understanding of Israel's tribal structure follows the traditional pre-monarchical order. In other words, the same 12 tribes are mentioned, even though the boundaries are different. Observation number 4. The tribal boundaries seem unconcerned about historical tribal realities. That's a mild statement. Observation number 5. The tribal boundaries run against the grain of natural topography. In other words, they run through mountains, across rivers, taking no account of the lay of the land. Observation number 6. The tribal parity allocations neutralize the inequities of the past and reflect the egalitarian ideals expressed earlier in Ezekiel 47 verse 14, each like his brother. It's well known that the tribes had different amounts of population, different amounts of territory, but in these tribal allocations in Ezekiel's vision, the tribes were all exactly equal. Observation number 7. The tribal allocations respect the traditional genealogical relationships among the tribes, distinguishing among the descendants of Jacob's wives, Leah and Rachel, and their handmaidens. No difference there. Observation number 8. The positions of Judah and Benjamin are reversed, as I've mentioned earlier. Observation number 9. The tribal allotments suggest a return to an ancient theocratic ideal. I don't know what Block means by that. I'll skip that one. Observation number 10. Levi's territorial ties differ radically both from the other tribes in this scheme, in Ezekiel's scheme, and from Joshua's allotments. In other words, originally, Joshua had the tribes of Levi scattered all through the land of Israel, both north and south. But here, Levi has an actual tribal allotment, which is totally different. So I think your only two options as to how to deal with this vision of the land allotment is either in the millennium, which I reject on other grounds, mainly that there will be atoning sacrifices in the millennium, which if you read it literally, if you read Ezekiel literally, that's what you end up with, and I think that's absurd, because Jesus has already provided the final atoning sacrifice that is necessary. The other option is that Ezekiel's vision of the land allotment and the temple is fulfilled in the church. We go now to Ezekiel 45, verses 7 through 8. The prince will have the land bordering each side of the area formed by the sacred district and the property of the city. All right, this is going to be a verbal textual description of what I told you from looking at the map, so I'm going to tell you again. The prince's land is to the east and west of the holy district in the center of the 25,000 by 20,000 cubit holy portion. And in the middle, going from north to south, the Levites have a square, a rectangle. The priests have a rectangle. And in the center of that rectangle is the temple. And then the south of the priest, there's a skinny rectangle for the city, the common people, with food storage on both sides of the city. So going back to Ezekiel 45, in the middle of verse 7, the border of the prince's portion will extend westward from the west side and eastward from the east side, running lengthwise from the western to the eastern border, parallel to one of the tribal portions. In other words, as you go across the top of that holy portion, you'll be south of the northern tribes and north of the southern tribes. That's hard to talk about. I can see it. That's not a problem there. Verse 8, this land will be his possession in Israel, and my princes will no longer oppress my people, but will allow the house of Israel to possess the land according to their tribes. So now, this prince, who is this prince that has the land? In the last chapter, Ezekiel 44, I decided the prince could not be the Messiah. That's because one of my commentators pointed out that in Ezekiel 46, verse 2, the prince offers a sacrifice, and a Messiah would not be offering a sacrifice. And I bought that argument. I've changed my mind by the time I get to this chapter. My bad. We read in Ezekiel 46, 2, that the prince should enter from the outside by way of the gate's portico and stand at the doorpost of the gate while the priest sacrifices burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. The priest is sacrificing the burnt offerings of the prince, which sounds like the prince can't be the Messiah. However, there are a lot of commentators who do take this prince as the Messiah, so they don't have a problem with this verse. And the way I would explain this is that these sacrifices being offered by the priest in the vision are a symbol of what Jesus did on the cross, of what Jesus did on the cross. He offered himself as a sacrifice, and this prince offering a burnt offering is just a symbol of that, a type of that, if you will. So we are going to assume now that the prince is the Messiah. And again, that's controversial. That's just my opinion. Adam Clark thinks that it's the civil magistrate, but the Church of Jesus Christ, the New Covenant Church, which is what I believe Ezekiel's temple is foreshadowing. The New Testament church doesn't have a civil magistrate. I'm tempted to think, oh, this is where the Pope comes in. No, we're not going to go there. So the secular princes are no longer going to oppress old Israel, but the new leaders of the church, led by the prince, will, of course, no longer oppress the people of the church. We go now to Ezekiel 45, verses 9 through 12. This is what the sovereign Lord says. You have gone far enough, O princes of Israel. Give up your violence and oppression and do what is just and right. Stop dispossessing my people, declares the sovereign Lord. You're to use accurate scales, an accurate ephah, and an accurate bath. The ephah and the bath are to be the same size, the bath containing a tenth of a homer and the ephah a tenth of a homer. The homer is to be the standard measure for both. The shekel is to consist of 20 gerahs. 20 shekels plus 25 shekels plus 15 shekels equals 1 mina. Well, that's a bunch of Hebrew measurements. We're not going to worry about that. But we are seeing that the standard weights were lost when the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians. And so now we have a new standard. Now, Ezekiel is using Old Testament terminology. But the main point is that in the New Covenant church, there needs to be honesty in dealings one brother with another. And if you start distorting measurements, that's just out-and-out fraud. That's not the sort of thing that ought to go on between brothers. The ephah mentioned in verse 10 is a Hebrew unit of dry measure, equal to about 35 liters. And the bath is a Hebrew unit of liquid measure, equal to a quantity varying between 10 and 11 U.S. gallons. That's from dictionary.com, in case anybody's interested. We go now to Ezekiel 45, verses 13 through 17. This is the special gift you are to offer. A sixth of an ephah from each homer of wheat, and a sixth of an ephah from each homer of barley. The prescribed portion of oil measured by the bath is a tenth of a bath from each core, which consists of 10 baths or one homer, for 10 baths are equivalent to a homer. Also, one sheep is to be taken from every flock of 200 for the well-watered pastures of Israel. These will be used for the grain offerings, burnt offerings, and fellowship offerings to make atonement for the people, declares the sovereign Lord. All the people of the land will participate in this special gift for the use of the prince in Israel. It will be the duty of the prince to provide the burnt offerings, grain offerings, and drink offerings at the festivals, the new moons, and the Sabbaths, all the appointed feasts of the house of Israel. He will provide the sin offerings, grain offerings, burnt offerings, and fellowship offerings to make atonement for the house of Israel. Now, all of that is hard to follow. That's Old Testament language, a bunch of measurements, which I'm not going to go over. But the point is, all of these measurements are to measure portions of the sacrifice, the gift that was to be given to the prince. And that's why I think the prince is the Messiah. The people of the new Israel here will be giving offerings to Jesus. All the people of the land, verse 16, will participate in the special gift. Now, we give gifts to Jesus. Christians do. Verse 17, it will be the duty of the prince to provide the burnt offerings, grain offerings, and drink offerings. Now, that fits with the idea that the prince is the Messiah very well, because now the prince himself is a type of all the offerings he makes. The grain offerings that he makes in the temple show that Christ is the bread of life. The drink offerings that he makes in the new Ezekiel temple, the drink offerings are the blood that Jesus shed. The burnt offerings that the prince makes are a type of Jesus who was wholly consumed as he offered himself up for us, the whole burnt offerings, the Holocaust. Now, this special gift that's given, there are several options as to what the gift was for. It could have been for the dedication of the new temple, for the maintenance of the priest, daily sacrifices. It doesn't really matter. Now, an interesting point to note here is how the prescribed measures of offerings and such are so different than in the law of Moses. First of all, in verse 13, the gift that's to be offered to the priest is a sixth of an ephah. A sixth, not a tithe, but a sixth. A sixth of wheat and barley to be given to the prince is more than a tithe that was to be brought to the temple. So that's something that's different. And we also see that the amounts of the gifts given in Ezekiel's temple to the priest were smaller than the amounts to be given in Moses' temple. only the 60th part of wheat and barley would be given, the 100th part of oil, and only one lamb out of 200. So the amount of offerings is different. And of course, I think the reason why is because Ezekiel doesn't want anybody to think this is referring back to the old Israel. He's looking forward to the new Israel in his prophetic vision. We go now to Ezekiel 45, verses 18 through 20. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. In the first month, on the first day, you are to take a young bull without defect and purify the sanctuary. The priest is to take some of the blood of the sin offering and put it on the doorpost of the temple, on the four corners of the upper ledge of the altar, and on the gatepost of the inner court. You are to do the same on the seventh day of the month for anyone who sins unintentionally or through ignorance, so you are to make atonement for the people. Now, in verse 18, we see reference to the first month on the first day, that's Nisan the first. Nisan, of course, was the month that the Jews were delivered out of Egypt. Now, this is different than the first month under the Mosaic Law. In the beginnings of the months under the Mosaic Law, the Jews were to offer a burnt offering of two young bullocks and a ram. Here we just have a young bull. In Numbers 28:11, we read this: at the beginning of each of your months, present a burnt offering to the Lord, two young bulls, one ram, seven male lambs a year old. That doesn't match with what Ezekiel has. He just has a young bull. That's it. Now, the sprinkling of the blood here is totally different in Ezekiel's temple. It's not mentioned in the Law of Moses. It's mentioned a little bit out of order here, at least in the NIV translation. Let's start at the east, at the gatepost of the inner court. That's the gate structure that separates the outer court from the inner court. There were two gateposts there, if you will recall, and blood was supposed to be sprinkled on those two gateposts. Then as you go further west, you hit the altar. You put blood on the four corners of the altar. Keep going west till you get to the door of the sanctuary itself, the door of the holy place. And there's some more doorposts there. You sprinkle on that. And we see that that is totally different than is in the Law of Moses. The symbolism, of course, is you want to get into the sanctuary of God. You got to go by way of blood. Same sort of symbolism, same meaning. It's just done differently. So entry into the church of God is through the blood of Christ. Now in verse 20, on the 7th of Nisan, the same ritual is to be done. Sacrifice of a young bull, sprinkling of the blood on those three things. The two gates, the gate to the inner court, the gate to the sanctuary itself, and in the middle, the four corners of the altar. Same thing. It's done on day 7, Nisan 7, as is done on Nisan 1st. That is totally not in the Law of Moses. Again, the point is, this is something different. This is something new. This is the new Israel, not the old Israel that we're talking about here. Ezekiel 45, verses 21 through 25. We will look at this, and we will conclude this chapter. Yahweh continues, in the first month, on the 14th day, you are to observe the Passover, a feast lasting 7 days, during which you shall eat bread made without yeast. Now, of course, that's very similar to the Passover feast. In fact, it's the same day, Nisan the 14th, as you know. The feast lasting 7 days, that would be the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which comes after the Passover. And in the New Testament, Passover and unleavened bread were conflated. Sometimes people would say unleavened bread, they mean the 8 days. Sometimes they would say the Passover, meaning 1 day. Sometimes the Passover, meaning the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So when it says a feast lasting 7 days, I'm assuming they are referring to the Feast of Unleavened Bread that comes after the Passover, during which you shall eat bread made without yeast. The yeast, of course, symbolizes sin. We get rid of the sin, get rid of the yeast. On that day, the prince is to provide a bull as a sin offering for himself and for all the people of the land. I've already said I believe that the prince is the Messiah. The sin offering that's offered, a bull here, is symbolic of his own blood that he gave when the antitype came, when Jesus came. Now, this business about a bull on Passover day, this is totally different than the Levitical law, as John Gill points out, who says this and all the other sacrifices offered by the prince are not in the Levitical law. Gill says, quote, under the law, every family was to prepare a lamb for themselves, but here the prince is to prepare for himself and for all the people of the land. And by that it was to be a lamb, here a bullock, and that for a sin offering, whereas not a bullock but a goat was used for a sin offering. You think the Passover lamb, but here's the Passover bullock. Ezekiel's really changing things up here. And also, it was done by families. Passover was during the time of Moses, but here the prince is preparing it for all the people of the land. So you see continuity and discontinuity, as the theologians like to say. Now, verse 23, every day during the 7 days of the feast, that's the Feast of Unleavened Bread, Passover, he is to provide 7 bulls and 7 rams without defects. That's a bull and a ram for each of the 7 days. And, of course, that's different than the law of Moses, which required 2 young bullocks, 1 ram, and 7 lambs. We read in Numbers 28:19, present a fire offering, a burnt offering to the Lord, 2 young bulls, 1 ram, and 7 male lambs a year old. So Ezekiel says 7 bulls, Moses says 2 bulls. Ezekiel says 7 rams, Moses says 1 ram. Ezekiel doesn't say anything about lambs. Moses says offer 7 male lambs for the Feast of Unleavened Bread. We go to verse 24 and we see some more differences. The prince is to provide as a grain offering an ephah for each bull and an ephah for each ram. That's different than the Mosaic law, as John Gill says. According to the law, 3/10 parts of an ephah of fine flour were only allowed to make a meal offering for 1 bullock and 2/10 for a ram. So 1/10 for a bull, 2/10 for a ram, but in Ezekiel, it's a whole ephah for each bull, not 3/10 of an ephah for a bull, as Moses said, but 1 whole ephah. And Ezekiel says an ephah for each ram. Moses says 2/10 of an ephah for a ram. Big difference. Again, we emphasize the differences. In verse 24, we see another difference. The prince is to offer a hin of oil for each ephah of grain that he offers. The law of Moses says in Numbers 28:14, their drink offering shall be 1/2 hin of wine for a bull, and 1/3 hin for the ram, and 1/4 hin for a lamb. Well, we just have bulls and rams in Ezekiel, and for each bull and each ram, it took a hin of oil to satisfy the requirements in Ezekiel, but in Numbers, it only took 1/2 hin for the bull instead of a whole hin, and 1/3 hin for the ram instead of a whole hin. So more differences. Now, having finished with Passover, Ezekiel and Yahweh moved in verse 25 to the Feast of Tabernacles. During the 7 days of the feast, which begins in the 7th month, that's Tishri on the 15th day, Tishri 15 is when the Feast of Tabernacles was, he is to make the same provision for sin offerings, burnt offerings, grain offerings, and all, the same as with the Passover. Now, that's another huge difference. Now, let me read you what John Gill says. The same things are to be done at this feast as at the feast of the Passover, according to the sin offering, according to the burnt offering, and according to the meal offering, and according to the oil, that is, so many bullocks and rams for the burnt offering, and a kid of the goats for the sin offering as before, and the same quantity of fine flour and oil for the meal offering. This also is a new thing. For according to the law, the sacrifices at the feast of Passover and at the Feast of Tabernacles were very different, but they're exactly the same. So the sacrifices in Ezekiel's temple have the same sacrifices required at Passover and at Tabernacles, but in the time of Moses, the differences were very great. Gill goes on to say that it might be further observed that no notice is taken of the Feast of Pentecost or First Fruits, and the whole confirms what has been already observed, that this shows the abrogation of the Mosaic economy, and that these things are to be understood in a spiritual and evangelic sense. And I agree with that thoroughly, 100%. The old Israel has morphed into the new Israel. There is some continuity, so we can still see that the new Israel, the church, grew out of Israel, but there's enough different to show that new things have come. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, thus it is implied that the letter of the law is to give place to its spirit. Those outward rites of Judaism having no intrinsic efficacy, but symbolizing the spiritual truths of Messiah's kingdom. I cannot think of a better way to close this chapter. Let's forget a millennial temple and millennial sacrifices. Let's think about the church, the sacrifices of Jesus done in the church, and the sacrifices of praises we offer back to Jesus. Ladies and gentlemen, on that happy note, we have finished Ezekiel chapter 45, and we are now prepared to go to Ezekiel chapter 46 in our next audio, which I will entitle The Prince and the Feast. I hope to see you in the next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.